Welcome back to Dave's Gone By and to the neighborhood where we have a really, really special guest with us on the phone. This is someone, if you grew up like me with a lot of TV watching in the 1970s, you saw this woman for 11 seasons on The Carol Burnett Show, hired in an amazing way, which I hope she'll tell us about, just one of those sheer wonderful serendipitous showbiz stories. But the story did not stop there. I mean, after The Carol Burnett Show went off the air, there was another big TV program that she did. She had a hit single on the charts. And even now, years later, she is continuing to make people laugh and to give people enjoyment. As a matter of fact, a week from now, she will be physically in Greeley, Colorado, performing at the Union Colony Civic Center with her one-woman, two-character show. I hope I'm describing that correctly, but we will ask her because she's on the phone with us in the neighborhood right now. Please, everyone, say hello to Vicki Lawrence. Hey, Vicki, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you, Dave?
Oh, fine. I'm wonderful. It's been a relatively mild winter here so far, so that's the best you can ask for in Colorado.
I know. Mild there. I guess the East Coast is getting it this year, huh?
Yeah, which, I'm a New Yorker born and bred. I didn't move out here until last summer. So for me, all those people, I tell this story all the time on the air, but when we left and decided to come to Colorado, all the family, all the friends were like, well, I hope you brought your snow boots. I hope you got your hats and your woolly mittens.
So you're enjoying a nice balmy winter and you can call home and gloat, right?
Every time they get a snowstorm, I'm like, oh, you digging out today? Oh, yeah, it's kind of sunshiny here, but I feel sorry for you. I'm an evil person. How much of your life now is spent on going and touring like you're doing and just kind of having a life post the years in Hollywood, the years on TV and stuff like that?
Oh, it's enough to keep me busy, and it's, you know, I guess I could work as much as I wanted to, you know, as much as I would like to. The show has been really, really well received, and it's been really fun for me to get out of Hollywood and go out and really see my fans out where they actually are.
How long was this particular trip, this tour? How many cities are you doing?
Oh, you know what? Our daughter is a professor at Colorado State now.
Oh, my gosh.
So I am coming in next week to spend a few days with her, and then I'm going to tootle into Greeley and meet my husband and my son, who take care of the show for me. So next week is just really all about Greeley and all about Colorado, and then we'll come home for, I think we come home for a bit before we go out again. So when you think tour, I think you think rock band on the bus, and that's not me. I go out, you know, like maybe a couple of weekends a month. That would be nice, and do a few shows. Once in a while, there's a long, you know, like a 14-day grueling trip, but oh my gosh, I don't know. I don't like it. I don't like that. Fogelberg all the time. The audience is heavenly. The traveling is hell.
Well, yeah, actually, although
you know, and anybody that travels will tell you, it ain't fun anymore. The TSA has no sense of humor.
Oh, I mean, we all get patted down. We all have to go through it now.
Although, I know.
I have to say, you are the first celebrity that I have ever heard who has said the phrase, next week is all about Greeley. I don't think in the history, going back to the 1700s, I don't think anybody has ever said that, but it's happy to...
Well, I got very excited when I heard it was like a half hour from where our daughter is, and I went, oh, great, oh, goody.
Well, cool. Well, I wish you had the time to stop here at the radio station. We would love to see you, but at least we've got you on the telephone here to talk to you about your life and your career, and why don't you please tell us the amazing story, and make sure that Wikipedia got it right, of how you went from just being sitting at home watching TV to being physically on the most popular sketch comedy show since your show of shows.
I actually, when we put this show together, I knew that my half of the show would be largely autobiographical because I know from speaking to audiences, doing a lot of speaking engagements, I know all the things that people would ask me if I were to bump up the lights, as Carol used to do, and take questions and answers. So the first story that I tell in my show is how Carol found me. And so I don't want to spoil it too much, but I wrote her a fan letter. I wrote fan letters to everybody, actually, when I was a kid. Everybody that was on television when I was a kid, I had an 8x10 picture of them plastered all over my bedroom walls. So anyway, when I got to high school, everybody started telling me that I looked like Carol Burnett. So by the time my senior year rolled around, I entered a local contest mm-hmm. called Miss Fireball. And the newspaper gal, in doing an article about the contest, mentioned that I looked like Carol Burnett. And my mom said, write a fan letter. Write Carol a fan letter. I knew who Carol was. I can't say that I was a huge fan. She was, I think she was on, I'd seen her on the Gary Moore Show. I had seen her do Once Upon a Mattress on television.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, I and as I say in the show, I was really trying to be Mary Tyler Moore. I was,
oh.
I was in love with her on the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Right, well.
You know,
yeah.
Love. I had the little hairdo, and I wore the little, you know, capris, and I really loved Mary Tyler Moore. But everybody said, and then I cut my hair when I went to high school, and everybody said, you look like Carol Burnett. So I wrote her the fan letter, and I, of course, tell this whole story in my show, and she made arrangements to come and see this contest
that I was in.
Just, I don't know, on a whim, the woman is nuts. She does a lot of stuff just on hunch, on gut, you know.
Right.
And she did over the years on our show. She had she would have find people that she just thought were great that she wanted on her show, and everybody else would go, well, "What are you talking about?" You know, we just went on a hunch all the time. And now I think if you were to, because I was such a kid, I was when we met, I was 17 years old in high school.
Yeah.
When I met Carol. I went to work on a show after I graduated from high school. I started at UCLA the same fall that I started on the Carol Burnett Show. And I think nowadays, the suits would come downstairs from up, you know, and say, get rid of her, please, and get an actress. Get her gone. Because I don't know where you get to just be an idiot and learn your craft in front of America.
That's called being a politician.
Yeah, I get, you know, I guess American Idol might be the closest thing now, but those people are so good out of the gate.
Right.
Most of them, you know. There's not a lot of room to fail anymore.
But here's the question.
On television, you know what I mean? You don't get there's no training ground. So,
but here,
it was, you know, I say I went to the Harvard School of Comedy in front of America.
And what gets me is you hear about the lifestyles of people who are doing television shows every week and the ridiculous hours and the way they get through it, things like Saturday Night Live or even the sitcoms or the drama shows. You were trying to do that and at the same time go to UCLA, full-time to UCLA. How did you do that?
Well, I didn't. I don't know that I went full time. You know, the rule was you may go to school as long as you're at the studio by 10 o'clock. So I took every class you could take at 7, 8 a.m. You know, so that I could, because UCLA was in very close proximity to CBS.
Oh, okay.
So I was on and off campus before most people were even awake. You know, so I didn't really have a whole lot of a college life. not like most kids. And and then I would go to, but the Burnett Show did not run like shows run today. You know, I'll have young people say to me, I'll be guesting somewhere, and they'll say, oh, gosh, you guys must have had so much fun. And I just look at the way shows run nowadays, and I just go, oh, my God, you have no idea. We had, you know, we got paid for playing dress-up. That show ran, it was such a tight ship.
Yeah.
That unlike any other show I've ever done, if the schedule said you would be done at 3 in the afternoon, you could make a 3:30 appointment and keep it.
Wow.
You know, it just ran. It ran like a top. And then we shot on Friday nights. We would shoot two shows, but literally, like, practically live. We didn't stop unless it was for a monstrous costume change or a huge set change that they just could not make in, you know, in record time.
Yeah.
But we would do an hour show in roughly an hour and a half. So the audience really, really, you know, had a great time with us. And I think that came through across the screen. I think that's why people still love to watch it, because it's like you're there.
And also, we know that they didn't stop tape or cut when someone started laughing or
no.
You know, if one of the actors broke up. That's become some of the
right.
Most cherished.
Yeah, no, it was as close to a live show as you could possibly do.
Do you have a favorite sketch from...
Oh, my gosh. No, that is too hard a question. That's like 11 years of memories, you know? No, I could not pick out a favorite sketch. With so many. I loved doing the movie. I came to love the movie takeoffs. In the beginning, when I was really young, half the time I didn't even know who I was in those movie takeoffs. Harvey would have to explain it to me, you know?
Yeah.
that Carol was such an old movie buff that, you know, we did all the old movie takeoffs. I would have to go back and watch a lot of them. Loved all the musical stuff we did. Loved, of course, the family, Mama and Eunice and Ed. It's just, I don't know. It's all just so much fun, all of it.
And, well, I guess the one question we're all wondering is, what is Kim Conway really like?
Oh, isn't that, well, he's a nutcase.
Is he really? Yeah, well, a good kind of nutcase, I'm sure.
He lives, just a good crazy nut. He lives to make you laugh. He lives to, I mean, we used to be, if we were standing in the hallway of our rehearsal hall, and on any given Monday, and the elevator would come up, and Tim would be in it, and, you know, Farby and Carol and I were standing around. The doors would open. Tim would be standing there doing nothing visible that I could see, that any of us could see, and Harvey would go down for the count. I actually, until Harvey passed away, Tim used to say that he had custody of Harvey. And he just lived to make people laugh. He would do all kinds of crazy things. I remember we flew down to the Sydney Opera House, I think in 1972, 73, to open the Sydney Opera House.
Wow.
We were the first show in there, and it was very exciting. And back in those days, you know, it was, I think it still takes forever to get down there, but, you know, we went on Qantas. It was like a 22-hour trip, and Qantas would give you sleep masks, you know, to put on so you could, put a mask on and drool in privacy, I guess. So anyway, we get down to Australia. It's been a horrendously long trip, not a peep from anybody. And as we hit the runway, here comes Tim, who, you know, he was a gymnast in college.
Oh.
So he comes rolling down the aisle in first class, and he's careening off the seats on either side of the aisle. And the flight attendants are in their jump seats, and they're going, "Oh, he's rolling down the on the floor, rolling down the aisle. He slams against the pilot door. He stands up. He turns around. He's got the sleep mask on like a bra. And as the plane rolls to a stop, of course, nowadays he'd be arrested, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As the plane rolls to a stop, he looks at all of us and says, "Wow, rough landing," and walks back to his seat. He's nuts. He just lives to make everybody laugh.
Oh my God.
And of all of us, he was really the non-rehearser. He was always over in the corner building something with the prop man or rewriting his lines. We used cue cards, they still do use cue cards. But, like Carol was black and Harvey was red and Tim was green and I was blue. And if in any given sketch, if you looked out in the audience and you saw a green card that had the word "saver" scrawled across it, it meant, here comes the joke from Tim that nobody has heard that is going to save the whole sketch. So you'd look out, you'd see Saver, and you'd go, "Oh boy, here we go. Here we go."
And so you didn't even
necessarily... The great thing is you all got to sit at home and watch that nonsense.
Right, but you guys didn't even necessarily know the whole sketch put together until that moment that you were doing it. I mean...
Not if Tim was in it. You never knew what was going to happen. He would take a left turn, and you'd be off on the I-40 before you knew it. And there you have it.
And whereas Harvey was more traditional, Harvey Korman?
Harvey and Carol and I were all the rehearsers. I mean, it took me years before I would dare to crack anybody up because I didn't feel like I had really earned the right to play in a sandbox with the grown-ups, you know?
Mm.
So I was very studious and serious and took my craft, very seriously. Was really trying to learn to be one of them. And Ken, I remember when Tim finally got written into the family sketches as Mickey Hart.
Mm-hmm.
And Carol, we got a lecture, the first sketch he did, we got a lecture from her saying, "This, you know how important these sketches are to me, and I really don't like breaking the fourth wall, and we really got to keep it together." And of course, you know, you never did with Tim. You never could. She, of course, would be the first one to fall apart and, you know, start laughing.
I mean, did you pride yourself as being the one who was hardest to break up? Because it was Harvey who would be gone, and she would have trouble. Was that part of your thing, like, "I'm not going to lie," or even you, when you're in that situation, you can't help it?
Not really pride. I just didn't feel that I had earned the right. I didn't think, you know, it took me a lot of years to feel like I had earned the right to do.
Be broken up by the others. In other words...
Even be in a caliber or a league with them, so... I was a very serious little comedy student.
Well, what are things that by doing the Carol Burnett Show, by doing Mama's Family, and then by doing the things that you've been doing ever since then, what are tips and things that you have learned about doing comedy, be it on television or in front of a live audience, that students who might be in the performing arts school might find useful?
Oh, gosh. The most important thing to do on stage or in comedy, or anywhere, is to listen. Listen to what's going on, because you never know when a moment might come along where somebody misses a line or says something differently. You need to be very present and really pay attention to what's coming out of everybody else's mouth, because you never know when you might need to go somewhere else. And if you're, we used to have guest stars that would come on the show that would rip out every page that they weren't on, and they would literally learn a monologue. And they did not know what to say until they heard their cue. And I have learned over the years, hardcore, boy, you better be paying attention, because you just never know what's going to happen up there. The other thing that is so great is that it doesn't matter how many times you do a show or a skit, every audience is different. Every audience has its own personality and its own vibe. And I used to listen to, I used to be amazed that Carol Channing did Hello, Dolly! On Broadway. How many performances? It was, I don't know, Dave. Do you know the statistic? It's like it's well over 1,000.
Oh, yeah, much more than that. I mean, 1,000 on Broadway is only like 3 years of performances.
3 years, maybe. So, well, she did thousands and thousands. And I used to think, how does she do the same thing every night? And what I have learned doing my show, night after night, is that every audience is different, and you go on a ride with a new set of fans every night, and you never really know where you're going to go. So you really need to be present, you really need to be there, and you really need to be paying attention, because you might miss a golden opportunity. You know?
What have you learned then since you've been doing your one how long have you been doing the one woman show?
We put this show together on the heels of the first huge Burnett reunion, which aired in 2001. And so in the beginning of 2002, we started putting the show together. And I literally got together people that I trusted. My husband, stage manager that had done my talk show with me. Well, I mean, the stage manager, actually, we came up all the way together from the Burnett Show through Mama's Family onto my talk show. One of the producers from Mama's Family. I had a writing partner that I found when I was doing my talk show. It was a very little, and a musical guy to help me with the music. And a little small group, and it was literally like Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, let's push the furniture back and let's do a show, kids.
Wow.
And we put it together during that spring, and I said, I just really want to take people away from, you know, it's kind of on the heels of 9/11. I said, I want to take people away from everything, that's all the craziness that's going on in the world, and just make them laugh for 90 minutes. So that's what we set about to do. And I said, I know the first half needs to be largely autobiographical, hopefully funny, because my life has been nothing if not hysterically funny. And then the second half, I knew I had to bring Mama out of the closet, because everybody loves her so much that sometimes I think it wouldn't matter what happens to me, as long as she's around, nobody would really miss me.
Oh, yeah, so, totally.
I know how popular she is, but I said, I want to bring her out of the closet, but I want her now to be topical. I want her to be, I want to bring her into the new century. So that part of my show changes more often than anything else, because I like to keep her on top of the news. You know, like, I'm thinking now, here comes Greeley, and I haven't worked. The last time we worked was before Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to my writing partner yesterday, you know, we really need to talk about Snooki, and we really need to talk about Charlie Sheen, and we, you know, so we're working on some new stuff.
Well, that's the shocker.
The world is ever-changing.
I played just before we went on the, well, you got on the air with us, I played the clip that's gone viral on YouTube and some other places, where you were suddenly front page news on AOL, of all things.
Oh, I know.
I mean,
what is up with that?
Suddenly there you were. Well, there Mama was, talking about
yes.
her version of the Ted Williams situation. I mean, was that just you and your writing partner saying, okay, we've written it, it's hysterical, we got to get it out there, like, today?
Well, you know, I've had, Dave, everybody is always saying to me, why don't you, you know, they'll see my show, and they'll say, why don't you put some of these little snippets on YouTube, because it would be hysterical, and it would cheer us all up, and we'd laugh, and it would be fun. So this is like the first time I've ever, that was my first attempt at a YouTube video. That's the first thing I have ever done. I mean, there's lots of stuff on YouTube that's, you know, Carol Burnett's show, and Mama's Family, and all that, real, you know, kind of related stuff, which is great fun to go back and look at, but homeless mama was the first was my first foray into YouTube, and it's
Were you expecting the reaction? I mean, I really found it very, very funny. Not a fan.
99% of the reaction has been positive. You know, because my husband is the one that opened the YouTube account, so he gets all of the comments, and I would have to say 99.9% of the comments have been positive. What I really didn't like was the article that little AOL guy did. He sort of led people into the video as if it was me ranting, and it is not. It's a crazy old lady. It was a crazy old, you know, and the whole thing started when there's Ted Williams, and he's hugging Matt Lauer and Meredith Vieira, and I'm going, well, for heaven's sake. And then the next day you see him hugging Robin Roberts, and I'm going, okay, this is something Mama could get riled up about, this guy getting all this attention. You know, she's sitting in Raytown, Kansas, going, damn it, I would like to go out there and hug Matt Lauer. You know, I'd like to meet Kobe Bryant.
Right.
Anyway, so I put my little rant together, and then it got... any negativity at all is just, I don't know, it was just...
I was surprised that there was any negative. I mean, it's not anti-homeless, it's not anti-anything, it's just...
No, I am definitely not anti-homeless, please let's get that straight. We give to every shelter in our neighborhood. It's not, you know, more than a rant about Ted Williams, I kind of think that piece was sort of a comment on today's media.
On celebrity, of course it is, about how people suddenly... with, you know, their
15
minutes.
But you're on a street corner one day, and 2 days later, you are a household name.
Right, but the problem is then
frightening,
what do you do?
Really frightening for him, very frankly, I think.
Well, he went right to rehab.
And now, of course, the poor guy is in rehab, and it's really up to him, you know, because some people have said I'm stereotyping homeless people. I think he kind of did, and now it's up to him to sort that out, straighten that out, and prove himself. Now I'm hoping he'll come out of rehab, he'll get himself together, and then Mama and Ted Williams could have a sitcom. What do you think?
Well, he could be the announcer at the very least, you know.
We could do, we can redo, I don't know, the Brady Bunch, or we can redo Ozzie and Harriet, the Golden Years. I don't know what we're going to do.
I'm wondering. We have to think that one over. Odd Couple, in a very strange way.
The Odd Couple. There you go. All in the family.
Yeah.
Mama can play the Archie Bunker role, and he can be,
Meathead would be mean. No, what could he be? Well, Frank Lorenzo.
Well, I think he'd do a role reversal, and the wife would be the one who's the bigot, and the husband would be the one who's more like Edith Bunker.
I don't think they ever did a sitcom of Neil Simon's The Sunshine Boys, but if you could put those two in an assisted living facility, that might be...
There you go. See, there's a plethora of good ideas.
Well, speaking of ideas, I'm gonna give this one to you for free, since you are coming to Greeley in 2 weeks, and you'll be around Colorado. It's actually gone national news, this whole thing about Martin Luther King Day. That was here. Not at this radio station, but a radio station about half a mile down the road. You must have heard about the guy who read that letter about Martin Luther King. Have you heard about this?
No, tell me what happened.
Oh, he's been doing this for the past 3 years. He's kind of a right-wing loon who owns a radio station around here that usually plays nostalgic music. Well, he decided to read this letter from a listener that completely runs down and tears to pieces the memory of Martin Luther King. I mean, calling him a communist, a liar, a degenerate, a pervert, a da-da-da-da-da. You know, only half of which is true. But anyway, he not only reads this letter once, but he was reading it 2 to 4 times a day. He was playing the tape leading up to Martin Luther King Day for like 3 weeks. And it just sparked this whole firestorm of why the hell is he, what is his point? He didn't write the letter, he says. But he's reading the damn thing, so he obviously agrees with it. And so, if you even mention that, and it went viral, it went all over, it was on Fox News, this little a-hole.
Oh, I missed it. Of course, now you see when I did the homeless video, I said, you know, we're just coming off that whole tragedy in Tucson, which is clearly not funny and was horrific and makes you wonder what in the world is the matter with people in this country. And when I saw Ted Williams show up, I thought, okay, now this is something that would make people laugh. Here's another instance of a guy. You know, it's interesting that people can write whatever they feel and push a button now, you know, on their computer and send it out there into space for everybody to look at. And there are no consequences. You're totally anonymous. And I think it's made a lot of people really not think about what it is they're saying. You know, because nobody's ever going to see them or...
Well, it's the equivalent now of...
Or get to rebut them or, you know?
Well, you know, there's that old thing of, in the old days, you would have a wild night out and then make that drunken phone call to the ex-girlfriend at 3 in the morning. Now it's the equivalent on MySpace or Facebook where, you know, you type the rambling message that the whole world sees. You hit the button, it's there.
Yeah, exactly right. Our little niece was out here visiting us a few months ago, and she's busy. She's on the phone one afternoon, and she is texting like mad. And it's been, you know, she's paying no attention to what we're talking about. Text, 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 text. Finally, my husband says, "What are you doing?" And she said, "I'm arguing with my boyfriend." And he said, "Oh, hold. You do not argue on a text message that, no, because you can't read anybody's intention on, you know, when it's typed. You can't hear intonations. But this is the way young people are dealing with everything now. We're sort of losing our communication skills.
I mean, I can't
and
imagine.
Consequently, yeah. I think, losing a lot of our sense of humor. Although I have to feel very gratified that most people understood what it was I was doing. I was just trying to make everybody laugh.
Yeah. It occurs to me now that there are obviously people texting each other Dear John letters, and they'd be like, D-R-J-O-H-N.
I know, really.
I-L-V-D-U. Interesting to see. Let me ask you about the... Do you have a few more minutes to stay with us, by the way?
Sure.
Oh, wonderful. I wanted to ask about the music career, because we haven't really talked about that. And that
people, well, I wouldn't call it a career.
Well, it was a hit. You had...
If it was a career, I'd be homeless like Ted Williams, I think.
Yeah.
If that was my career. Well, I had one hit.
Right.
You know, if you have one juggernaut, you must sing it. So I do sing that in my show.
Well, yeah. And people have made entire careers off one hit number. So it's not something
Well,
to be,
yeah.
And then, of course, that number is the night the lights went out in
Georgia.
Yeah,
easy for you to say.
It should have been. is it true, that's another Wikipedia story, that the song was originally going to go to Cher? Was that a...
Oh, the guy, I was married to the guy that wrote that song for like 10 minutes. And it was really the only good thing that came out of the marriage. I knew it was a hit. He hated it. I did the demo for him. We took it out to Hollywood. His producer said, it's a good song. He tried to give that song to everybody and could not get rid of it because nobody liked it. And I kept saying, it's a hit, it's a hit, it's a hit. Finally, he threw his hands up and said, okay, let's just go in the studio and do it with Vicky.
And then
I was right.
Oh, of course you were. It was this weird, strange, unhappy. It was like Ode to Billy Joe. This dark,
well, I'll tell you, it wasn't.
Song.
It almost wasn't written. It was not written in that eerie tone. The arranger, and I lobbied long and hard for the arranger, Artie Butler, because he had some stuff on the charts at the time that I really, really loved, and was not the arranger that the producer normally used. And he changed the whole thing from major to minor, all the chords. And when I heard it the first time, I said, oh, my God, where's the melody? He said, same melody. It's just gone major to minor. And so he gave it that whole eerie sound that it had.
Right, yeah.
So I think he was largely responsible for helping it become a hit, too.
So when you were in that mode, did you feel, were the record companies suddenly on you? Like, okay, you have to follow this up. You have to have another hit. You have to. Or were you so busy with Carol Burnett and all that at that point that... It was still.
I was very busy with the Carol Burnett show, and of course, it took like close to a year for that thing to become a hit. It just, you know, back in those days, things went slowly across the country, you know, and you'd hear, oh, we got Minneapolis, oh, we got Chicago, oh, guess what, we got Little Rock. You know, it was very slow to come across the country.
I hope you got Georgia.
It finally got to L.A. and it was a huge hit. Right. Then the producer said, okay, we need to do an album now. And by then, you know, that song had become the ultimate demise of an already doomed marriage. So it was like a very bittersweet going back into the studio to do an album that I didn't really have my heart in, because it was like, you know, the music business, maybe not for me. I just wanted to go back to the Burnett Show and make people laugh.
Can I ask what was...
So I sort of really didn't follow up on it the way I should have if I was, you know, if I'd have been really serious about a musical career. And also, you know what, Dave? Back in the days when I was growing up, you didn't cross-pollinate like the stars do now. You were a music star or a television star or a movie star. Movie stars never did television.
Right.
You know, television stars were like, it was amazing if they ever went to movies. Music star, you know, people in the music industry couldn't figure out. They'd call me to do interviews and they'd go, "Where have you been?" Well, I've been on the Burnett Show for 6 years. It's interesting how it has changed. Now you cross-pollinate or you're done, you know?
Yeah. And the English have been doing it forever. I mean, the British actors, I don't know why Americans never took our cue from
them.
Well,
I think the English are way ahead of us. You know, I don't know if you watched the Golden Globes the other night, but Ricky Gervais is taking so much heat for a lot of the stuff that he said on that show.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And I kind of feel like I do about my YouTube video, grow up, people. And I think the British are so much... they're so much easier with their comedy. We're just really thin-skinned here.
Well, I don't know if that was...
Need to lighten back up and start laughing at ourselves a little bit. Really.
I totally agree.
You know, because I think my motto has always been, life is much too serious to be taken seriously. And that's been my motto for years. And as life goes on and this world keeps progressing, I look around and I go, my God, my motto is just really becoming smarter than it ever was. And I think if you don't laugh at everything that's going on in this world, you're going to slit your wrists. And at the end of the day, if you're a mother like I am, you're the one that's going to have to clean up the mess. So it is best to keep laughing. You must keep laughing.
But here's a question. I mean, I have to ask, what on earth was so terrible about that first marriage? And if it, I mean, didn't you know it when you were walking down the aisle?
Oh, probably. It was a little dysfunctional. It lasted, that was less than a year. I really felt like a bimbo.
Oh, man.
But then I married my soulmate, my best friend, he was the makeup man on the Carol Burnett Show.
And you've been together 35 years.
And we were friends long before anything else happened. Yeah. And we have been married, my God, I guess we're going on... What are we going on, 37, 38 years or something like that?
Yeah. So what are some tips now? You've given us some tips for comedy. What are some tips for making a marriage last 3.5 decades?
Marry a friend. Oh. Marry a friend. Because I think, you know, romance comes and romance goes. And through the hard times, through the tough times, and through the good times, it's really good to have your best friend there. And somebody that makes you laugh. Somebody with a... to me, a sense of humor is like the most important thing in the world.
This is a really kind of precocious question, probably a stupid one, but have you had any hard times? It sounds like it's been pretty smooth sailing, except for that marriage.
Oh, well, yes, I did. You know, when I did my talk show, it was a horrible time in my life. It was great fun to do that talk show, but I did it for the wrong company. And I feel like, you know, you hear about actors hitting all those hard knocks when they're young. I hit the brick wall when I was 45 years old, and I was not prepared for it. And it was a very, very difficult time in my life. I mean, you know, people ask Al, my husband, they'll say, "How did you get through it?" And he'll just joke around and say, "I kept a half a fifth in me at all times." But it was just, it was a brutal period in my life. I went into a depression, and yeah, I talk about it when I go out. I go and do a lot of speaking engagements, generally for women's organizations.
Uh-huh.
You know, like when they do those women's expos, the health expos and such.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about how, and it's interesting that you'll find that most women in their midlife hit a brick wall, hit a tough period in their life. It can be a divorce, it can be a death, it can be an illness, it can be the empty nest, it can be kids that won't leave the nest, it can be getting fired, any number of things. And it happens to most women.
It was
a very tough period for me. It took me a long time to come out of that.
I mean,
a long time to really want to make people laugh again.
Wow. Did you get therapy and really, was it a real depression? Or was it just,
I
lost my job?
Everything short of doing any drugs. And it was interesting, when I finally came through it and started talking about it, I had all these drug companies calling me saying, you endorse our meds? And I said, well, you know, and it's funny, too, our daughter had a little part-time job at the pharmacy one summer working down here. Our local pharmacy hired her. She said, Mom, you cannot believe how many women on that island are on Prozac. I said, really? Anyway, I never did that, but I did everything else. I hired a trainer. Hmm. I did an enormous amount of reading. I learned to transcendental meditation.
Do you still do
I
that?
Got a bicycle. Yeah. I got a Labrador Retriever. it was a long voyage back to being to wanting to be funny.
Wow. And
yeah. Probably the toughest time in my life, I would say.
What was the moment when you got back on the horse?
There was no moment. I don't even remember that a cloud lifted. It cleared, I guess, like the morning fog. It was a slow process, and at one point I finally decided, okay, I'm ready to laugh again. But I guess that was probably shortly before the first Big Burnett reunion.
Hmm.
So it was out, and then it was after that that we put this road show together. But yeah, it was a long haul for me.
Wow. Yeah, and I even meant as far as climbing back.
And then, of course, I'm sure everybody can relate to the period you go through when you're losing your parents. It's a horrible time in your life.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. No. Were they very close together as far as when they left, or was it,
My dad outlived my mom by about 10 years.
So they weren't that close.
And 12 years, yeah. But, you know, it's sad. Losing your parents is a hard thing. So, no, we all have hard times.
Oh, sure.
I just choose not to focus on those too much unless somebody really, really wants to talk about, you know, like when I go out and do a speaking engagement and we really want to talk about how you get the best way that I found to get through it. The best way I found was hard work and sweat, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I would never discourage my kids from doing anything that they felt strongly about. Our son directs my show right now.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
He's my director, so he's on the road with us. Our daughter is, I always tell her, is in show business of sorts because she's a professor at Colorado State. And she'll call me and say, oh, my God, you know, teaching two classes a day. I said, I know, it's like a two-show day.
Oh, yeah.
It's tough. You have to bring it. You have to bring it for the audience. And she's a great teacher. That's her stage, and she is a great teacher.
Well, we are talking.
But, you know, she's very seriously, you know, trying to save the forest.
Well, we just have a moment or two left with the wonderful Vicki Lawrence and thanking her so much for being with us. But I'm wondering, when you're not on the road and talking to your kids and writing and doing these viral videos, which I hope Mama will do more of, seriously.
Well, it hasn't really gone viral. Maybe you're going to help me.
Okay. Well, no, it was on AOL.
Maybe your listeners will go to YouTube, watch the video, and let me know if they think Mama has lost it or she's still funny.
Well, more importantly, the listeners should go to the Union Colony Civic Center on Saturday, January 29th to physically see you and Mama in person. That's where we really
particularly if they like that video, because you know she's going to be ranting about a lot of other stuff.
Exactly. So what are you doing when you're not... How do you relax? What are your hobbies? I think sailing, I saw somewhere that you're on water stuff. Am I right?
We do. Well, we live on a bay down here in Long Beach, and it's a great sailing community. So we love the boat. We love, both of us love cooking.
Mm.
What else? The dogs love goofing off with the dogs. And
also, you have more than one Labrador Retriever now. You have to get him a friend. I know that feeling.
We actually rescued a lab. Both of our dogs currently are rescued. We rescued a lab from Southern California Lab Rescue, which, you know, I would tell all my friends when they're looking for a dog, you can find any kind of a dog you want, any kind of a purebred dog on the internet. There are rescue groups for every breed,
mm-hmm.
and it's a wonderful thing to do. Like, steer clear of the pet stores. I learned that from Betty White a long time ago, because we're never going to stop that puppy mill stuff until we stop buying puppies out of the pet store windows. So, you know, I recently had friends that were looking for a Maltese. I said, there is a Maltese website. There's a website for everything.
Oh, yeah.
And then the other dog that we rescued, because we lost our lab, so we decided to rescue a lab, and I said, I can't do the puppy thing again. So we rescued a 7-year-old lab, and she is fabulous. And then we lost a little PBGV, which is a French
what?
Hunting hound.
Okay.
And we rescued a PBGV. So we have two of the same, you know, breeds, but we rescued them both. And they both know it.
they're great.
And they are both very, very happy to be in Long Beach.
Who wouldn't be? You know? Yeah. I'm in Colorado. We're due for an interesting show today.
It's a pretty nice spot.
Yeah. Well, it's been wonderful having you in our nice spot. But wonder, just before we let you go, can we hear one little bit more from Mama, her take on, I don't know, whatever Mama might want to say to her friends in Colorado, getting through the winter, getting through political whatever is on her mind, if she wouldn't mind.
My goodness, what is on her mind? What is the deal with those damn automatic toilets that flush three times before you can get your pants back up? Oh, it happens to me all the time at the airport. I swear, you get splashed more than a head of lettuce at Walmart.
There's really nothing I can add to that. And
I know.
It's funny because it's true. I know. Oh, Vicki Lawrence and Mama, please, everybody go see her Saturday, January 29th at the Union Colony Civic Center. And also, thank you, Vicki, so much for being with us in the neighborhood. It's been a delight.
Thank you for having me.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
You too.